So we are in 2 Samuel chapter 9. We'll pick up after our snow day, get back into the swing of things. 2 Samuel 9, we've really left the reign of Saul behind at this point, and we're fully into David as the king. And we're introduced in this time of David's life to some of the major changes that he made to the kingdom. So these two maps here show you essentially Saul's kingdom. And I am realizing you guys are going to think this is funny. The way the color shows up on this monitor is different than the monitor at my home computer. And all those colors look exactly the same to me. So this will probably mean way more to you than it does to me. But the one on the left is the kingdom during the reign of Saul. And then the one on the right is the kingdom during the reign of David. Some things to notice are like Philistia, the area of the Philistines is much larger. Phoenicia has a large territory. Aram has a larger territory. Ammon has a huge territory under Saul. And if you remember, I can see this. Okay, so these are two little pockets. These are areas that the Philistines had even come into. If you remember when Saul was defeated in battle, there were Jewish cities that the Philistines had taken over and conquered and owned right in the middle of Israel. Well, under David's reign, we're going to see a huge change to that. The Philistines, they get relegated to this little tiny chunk of land down there. The area of the Aram, they get pushed back. Phoenicia actually had a fair amount of a peace treaty with David. You'll hear about, we've talked a little bit about it before, but we'll see him more. Hiram, who was in charge of Tyre, was buddies with David. So they don't really take his territory, but even then, you can see that David's territory kind of spreads a little bit farther. These guys thin out a little bit. But especially down here in the land of Ammon and Moab and Edom, look at all that ends up belonging to David. So David will really spread the borders of Israel and remove a lot of the opposition from the nations around. And that means that David's going to spend most of his life at war. I mean, that's fundamentally what he's going to be, as a warring king. So much so that when he goes to build the temple, when he wants to do it, God will tell him, you can't do it because you're a man of who shed much blood. That's not going to be your role. He'll say, Solomon, your son, whose name means peace, will be a king of peace, and he'll do it. But David is a warring king, and he's very, very good at it. And God is with him, and there's a great deal of success. So David's, as you look through chapter 8, we're not really going to spend a ton of time looking at it. That's why I say we're really starting in chapter 9, because chapter 8 lays out a lot of David's conquests. And instead of going through each of those, what I want you to see is this is the effect of it, is that the borders are increased and his enemies, particularly the Philistines, become really marginalized compared to what they were. Does that make sense? Anybody have any questions? Anybody else colorblind? we good? Okay, so then in chapter 9, David's going to ask the question, as his kingdom and reign is established and he's doing so well, it says, is there yet anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? Now, we've looked at these two genealogies before, but over here is Saul and his lineage. Pretty much everybody at this point is gone. Jonathan died, Saul died, Abinadab and Malchishua all died in the same battle. Ishbosheth was the guy who reigned for 2 years, and Abner was kind of the brains behind that, who was the general. They both died at this point. These guys, the sons of Saul's concubine Rizpah, do not show up for quite a long time, so you don't even need to really remember. But what we're going to find is Jonathan will have had a son named Mephibosheth. and he will have survived. And so when David asks the question, is there anybody left of the house of Saul that I can show some kindness to for Jonathan's sake, it's going to come down to Mephibosheth. Now, this is a pretty amazing thing, and it's hard for us to really appreciate it because we live in a country of peaceful transitions. So our last president was President Obama. He was a Democrat, slightly different political beliefs than our current president. Don't know if you noticed. And slightly different political beliefs than the president before him, George W. Bush. And yet, when Trump was inaugurated, guess who was there at the inauguration? Trump was, Obama was, W. Bush was, and nobody died. We don't really appreciate how cool that is. That you can see transitions of power in America between people who have vastly different political views, and nobody dies. That is something somewhat unique to the American experience. It is not that way historically in other nations. Historically, the majority of time, what happens is when the next guy becomes in charge, he begins his dynasty and he starts it out by wiping out all of his opposition. That's what you see in places today, such as Libya. You'll see that in countries like Syria. I mean, it's very common all over the world that when people take over, they're gonna start with their regime. They're gonna make their own dynasty. My kids and their kids and so forth are gonna be the kings after them. And whoever it was that they had just kicked out, they're gonna kill everybody and just totally wipe them out. You're gonna see that sort of behavior again when Israel has its civil war later on. And the northern 10 tribes, they have all these problems. And whenever a new guy comes in and dispossesses the old guy, guess what he does? Kills them all. That's how it works in the vast majority of human history. We live in a beautiful time of peace and tranquility in comparison to the brutality that has existed in most nations for a very long time. So when David says, is there anybody of the house of Saul that I can show kindness to for Jonathan's sake? You are looking at something that not only was abnormal, it was unheard of. For David to say, the last guy who was in charge, is there anybody left of that dynasty that I could be kind to because Jonathan was kind to me? That is godly character at its finest in an era where that sort of thing wouldn't have happened. And I just mentioned that so that we don't miss what is a particularly profound good thing David did because of our cultural bias. I mean, we just, in our culture, that's not a big deal. We wouldn't think too much of it if President Trump sent a gift to President Obama at the changing of office. We'd go, oh, that was kind of nice. I mean, that was... Nobody, but it wouldn't be a giant thing. Here it's a giant thing. And so he's going to find out there was a servant in the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. And Ziba will then tell him about Mephibosheth, who was Jonathan's son, who is crippled in both his feet. And that came to be when they were fleeing, by the way, that if you go down to verse 6, it says, Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David and fell on his... it was an earlier verse that mentions when that happened. When they were fleeing because they had heard that Saul had died, that is when the nurse that it was carrying Mephibosheth dropped him. And he became crippled at his feet from that day forward. So now David calls for him, and... finds out where he is, calls for him, and calls Mephibosheth in. And Mephibosheth does. He falls on his face and he prostrates himself and before David. And you can imagine why he would. David's first words to him are, Mephibosheth, and he said, here is your servant. And David says to him, do not fear. Why would David have to say, do not fear? That would be the expectation, right? We've found the last living person of Saul's lineage, so let's just get rid of him. Let's wipe him out. That would be the typical thing for one conquering king to do over another. So David tells him, "Do not fear. I will surely show kindness to you for the sake of your father Jonathan and will restore to you all the land of your grandfather Saul," which would have been a large amount of land, by the way. I mean, Saul would have owned quite a bit at that point. "And you shall eat at my table regularly." And again, he prostrated himself and said, "What is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me?" And then the king called Saul's servant Ziba and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and all his house I have given to your master's grandson. You and your sons and your servants shall cultivate the land for him, and you shall bring in the produce so that your master's grandson may have food. Nevertheless, Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall eat at my table regularly." And so David will enlist Ziba and his family to be in charge of the estate. Mephibosheth is going to essentially stay there with David in Jerusalem most of the time and eat at David's table regularly. The fact that David would allow all of these things to happen is just a monumental sort of thing that, as far as I'm concerned, just simply shows what happens to somebody when they allow their life to be shaped by God instead of man. There would have been no reason for David to do this, for him to elevate Mephibosheth in this way. A man who externally had nothing to offer, being lame the way he was, and that would have been something that's like, well, you don't want that guy eating at the king's table, and yet he does, and certainly his genealogy and all those sorts of things. So it's a pretty big deal. Then, chapter 10, we're going to cover very quickly, which is simply that David is going to overthrow Ammon and Aram. If you go back and you look at those charts there, Ammon and Aram are two major problem areas, major enemies of Israel at this time. And during the reign of Saul, they were a constant presence. David is going to push them back, win victory after victory, and will end up defeating them. Chapter 10 will not list every battle, but it'll list some interesting ones in particular. It's going to mention how the whole thing got started. In chapter 10, the Ammonites, when Nahash dies, David decides that he's going to send emissaries to show kindness to him. And the king of Ammon, his son Hanun, misconstrues that. And what he does is, in verse 4, Hanun took David's servants and shaved off half their beards, cut off their garments in the middle as far as their hips, and sent them away. The only purpose of that was to purely humiliate them. And so he does that, especially for a Jew. If anybody remembers, what was the law regarding beards for Jews? There was a rule. Don't cut them. Yeah, you don't cut the corners of the beard. No, you don't get to do the lumberjack trimming that we do. You know, no. You get to be scraggly, not like Jared over there where he's shaping it nicely and all that sort of thing. You just have to let it go. Well, they are specifically taking it and cutting off half of it in a way that would have been unsightly and would have been against Jewish law. Cutting off half their garments, sending them away embarrassed and humiliated. David will hear this of their humiliation, tell them to stay at Jericho until their beards grow back, and then come back, and that is what begins the war with the Ammonites. There's also an interesting thing there about how Joab and David will end up, with Joab and David's army will fight the people of Ammon back to back, which is kind of a cool story as well. But anybody have any questions or anything on chapter 10? Okay, so then we move into chapter 11. And chapter 11 is probably one of the more well-known sections of David's life where we're introduced to David's sin with Bathsheba. So up until this point, what we've been looking at is David under constant persecution due to Saul, then Saul's gone, and David has to fight this internal civil war, so that's a problem. And so he's dealing with that problem. And then he's been growing the kingdom and fighting all of these battles on every side of the nation and winning those battles. But now, for the first time, we're going to see David do something different. And chapter 11 says, "It happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David stayed at Jerusalem." This is specifically stated in the text because it was odd. This is something that would have not happened before. It's the time when kings go out to battle, is what's said. Well, who's the king, David or Joab? David's the king. So David doesn't go out. He sends his general out and his men out, but not himself. And so there is a lesson there that essentially when he was supposed to be out leading men, he decides to stay home and take his leisure. Now, there's a few things that I want to show you after we talk. We'll talk about the story here a little bit, but then I want to show you some archaeological things, a short little video, and then some pictures that will help give you a better idea. David's going to be, when it's evening time, he's going to arise from his bed and walk around on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof, he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. This is Bathsheba. He's going to call for Bathsheba. He's going to choose to lay with her, and then she's going to be with child. From there, there's going to be a series of very poor choices that David makes. He's already made one, and he's going to make some more. But that whole series of events of David walking around on the roof in the evening and then looking down and seeing a woman bathing, we now live in this really wonderful time where we have archaeological data about David's house that we didn't have even 5 years ago. So I'd like you to see some of that. So the first is probably about 4 minutes of video here, not really a whole lot more than that. Let's see if I can get it to come on up for me. Looks like it might be thinking.
Is it a URL?
Yes, it is.
You could probably just Google it.
Yeah, if it's not going to come up for us, that's exactly what I'm going to do. Oh, it's just coming up as a picture. Okay, so give me a second, I can find it very quickly. Okay. We'll see if the internet decides to help us here.
Important seal. 3 years later, we also found another seal. And these two seals are very, very important. Two seals that appears in the same book in the Bible, Jeremiah, in the same chapter, in the same verse, back to back to each other. Gedaliah ben Pashur, Yuchal ben Shelemiah. Written in the Bible, written on the seals. So that tells us that we are in the governmental area of that time. The time of King David dates back 3,000 years. The time of these guys, 2,800 years. And we know that in that time, this was the governmental seat of the city itself.
How does it make you feel to stand in a place like this where such an important point in Israel's history happens?
This city brings the Bible to life 360 degrees. The city of David, Jerusalem itself, leads in the fact that there is unequivocal proof that there is a connection to the Bible. In front of us, we can see a wall. It's this wall that led us to find the place here. And we can get a better vantage point of the palace area if we go to that side.
When you see the size of the walls, you can imagine how difficult that must have been for people to try to come and capture the city. And you understand why David would have sent Joab up through the water shaft to get inside.
Correct. If you go down, this even go down more to the Kidron Valley over there. And that's why the city was so difficult to take.
The city of David is such a great location strategically. You have the military fortifications. He's up high. He's surrounded by mountains. And when you talk about Iron Age cities, they're developing the fortifications. They're developing the fortified cities. You're getting more cities with walls. They're becoming less and less nomadic as a people.
You can see a house built into the wall itself. These houses that we found date back to the first temple period. This house belonged to Achiel. We know that because it was written in pottery that we found. This man, Achiel, was a very important person in the government as well. Firstly, his house is very close to the palace. Secondly, you can see his garage where he parks his donkeys. You can see two pillars over there with holes inside the pillars, and that's where he fastened the donkeys. But more than that, we found an ancient toilet. And for people like me in those days, you had to run a little bit further than your house to do certain things. Achiel had
a toilet. The luxury.
He had the luxury of that inside his house. Seeing houses built into the wall itself, we are reminded of the story of David and Bathsheba, when it says when the time comes when kings go out and fight, the men has to be out of the city, they have to go and fight, and the woman come outside. Bathsheba was taking a bath, and now we can see where he was standing and how this whole story played itself out.
Talking about David and Bathsheba is a hard thing to do. When you contrast David with Saul, he's just so starkly different. He's so much closer to God. He's the one described as the man after God's own heart. And then you get this incident where he chooses to take another man's wife to the point that to cover it up, he's willing to send that man into battle and have everyone step back so that he dies. So he has a valid reason to marry this widow so that he can adopt his unborn child. You know, that just seems so out of character for David. But the truth is, it highlights that he was a real man and he made mistakes. In many ways, he's more relatable. He also repented of those things. There were real life consequences. When he was confronted, as opposed to Saul, he repents and he responds. He doesn't make excuses. He takes responsibility. He's such a model for how to respond when your sin catches you and when you're found out.
We are reminded of the story when Absalom...
Okay, so... if you pay close attention to that video, let's see if I can go here. Here, to give you context, that video shows you a wall. This is that wall right here. That wall. So in this model of the city of Jerusalem, that wall they were standing on is right here. There are people who think that that is the Milo, which you'll read about sometimes in the Old Testament about David and Solomon and the Milo, and it was a big structure that was built. That's one of the potential locations of that. But at the very top of that, let me give you a little bit of context. Jerusalem got bigger as time went on. At this point, we don't have a temple. We don't have any of Solomon's building projects that he would eventually go on to do. The temple will eventually be built right up here. But at this time, Jerusalem is much smaller. And so the size of the whole city is right down here. And its highest point at that time is this. And it's David's house. David's palace at the time that we're reading about right now would have been the highest point in the city. And if you look at that location of that house right up there in the top, and that wall, which this picture doesn't show it, but they talked about there would have even been houses built into that wall. You stand up on the roof of that house, and you have a great view of every other house. And so when you talk about David going out on his roof and walking around on it, and he looks down and he sees Bathsheba, it would not have been surprising that that was the case, because he would have been one of the few people who would have had, due to his position as king, the vantage point to see that. And as I even mentioned in the video, you know, one of the things to consider is when the king goes out to battle with all the men, the city, for the most part, would have been primarily female at that point. You would have had women and children and only those men who were not capable yet of going to war or were too old to go to war. And so when you have David here and he stands out on his rooftop and he sees a woman bathing, what's the right answer for David? I mean, what does he do at that point? Turn away. That's right. Avert your eyes. So what we're seeing is two things in this story. We're seeing different milestones that led to the sin, and we're also seeing different milestones where the sin could have stopped right there. When it was time for the kings to go out to battle, that was a fork in the road, and David could have gone to battle like kings do, but instead he stayed home. When he's walking around on his roof, which has the best view of the whole city, and he sees a woman bathing, he could have averted his eyes, but he didn't. And then he calls for the woman. Right? He didn't have to do that. Like every single stage has two pieces to it. The choice he made and the obvious escape route. Because God tells us, with every temptation, what is he always going to provide? The way of escape. Now, there are a couple of ways to look at this with David, and very important to look at all of these different pieces to it. Because one is to say, okay, how do we not make that mistake? I mean, that's one very obvious thing that the Bible tells us, is that these are given to us as examples so that we wouldn't make the same mistakes. So the best choice here is to look at David's decisions and say, look, what can I do to back up the train so that doesn't happen to me? But there's also another piece to that puzzle, which is, if I find myself in the middle of something I ought not to be, what should I do now? Look for the next available escape route. Because David had that too. Because it wasn't just one chance where he could have changed course. There were multiple chances where he could have changed course. And then the third is to look at it and say, okay, he didn't. Here was a faithful man. He loved the Lord. But he blew it just completely and totally. What do you do now when the sin's committed and you're now confronted with this is what you did, which is what will be the case with David? How do you react to that? And so as we go through the story of David and Bathsheba, that's what we're doing, is we're saying, how does it actually work in the real world? Because if the Bible were written by men, David would never make this sort of mistake. Because when people tell stories about heroes, what do? Yeah, they're perfect. We gloss over any of the ugly spots, right? We cover those up. But here God lays it all out and says, this is exactly what David did. And David loved the Lord, and David will go on to do many good things, and he'd done many good things before, but he's going to suffer for this. And his suffering is written down, the consequences he faced, so that hopefully maybe we won't have to face the same sort of consequences. Or for us to see if we're in a circumstance where we are facing consequences for our own sins, which you do. I mean, people become Christians, and they bring their baggage with them, and they go, why am I still suffering for all these things I did in the past? Or you go through a season as a Christian where you're not as faithful as you ought to be. I mean, it'd be one thing if we were... I like this idea of my life as a Christian being this just constant trajectory upward. But in reality, it's not. For each of us, we have these seasons where we're not as faithful as we ought to be. We're not as focused on the Lord as we ought to be. We're not as diligent as we ought to be. We become complacent. And then we make poor choices, and then there are consequences for those. And that's the case for David here. He hits a stage where he wasn't as diligent as he'd been in the past, nor as diligent as he's going to be in the future. And he's going to pay consequences for that. But that doesn't mean the Lord doesn't love him. Right? As David, as you look at the rest of David's life, from the moment that he took Bathsheba, David's life will never be the same. But does the Lord love him less because of those consequences? No. But it is part of life here on earth that sin has consequences. And we wouldn't want to live in a world, by the way, where there wasn't a consequence for sin. Because if there wasn't a consequence for people committing sins, we like the idea of there not being any consequence for me committing a sin. Like, I like that. I like when I sin, there not being any consequences. But I wouldn't want to live in a world where anybody could sin and there'd be no consequences. Because that's not a just world. That's a world without justice, without truth, without righteousness. And so David is going to have to deal with those. But we're going to see the love of the Lord through it. The fact that the Lord doesn't abandon him. And the fact that the Lord rebukes him as a child of his. He disciplines him because he loves him. The Bible talks a lot about that. So there's a lot in this particular story, but it is also a pivotal moment in David's life. I have no doubt that if David could go back and, you know, rewind the clock, he would have made different choices. Does anybody have any comments or questions or anything like that on this so far? Okay. So for now, I'm going to just blank this out. David takes Bathsheba, lays with her, after finding out and inquiring of her. By the way, it says in verse 3, David sent an inquiry about the woman and once said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So he inquires about her, and he finds out her name's Bathsheba, and she's what? She's married. And in fact, she's married to somebody he knows. Anybody know who Uriah is? He's one of his mighty men. That's right. Of David's list of mightiest soldiers, these are the men who would do anything for David. When it talks about David's mighty men, it talks about when David wanted a drink of water from a well and several of them got up and just went and fought through the myriads of enemies just to get him a drink of water from that well. These are men who would die to please David. And Uriah is amongst that list. So now he's found out who she is. That's another milestone. And then it says, David sent messengers and took her. When she came to him, he lay with her. When she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, "I am pregnant." And so now David has a problem because his sin has consequences he wasn't expecting, which is she's pregnant, and where's Uriah? He's at war where David should have been. There's a lot of actual connections here between Uriah and David, because what you see is, as you look at the way David behaves himself, and now we're going to look at the way Uriah behaves himself, they're kind of put as opposites to each other. David stayed home. Uriah went to war. Then it says, David sent to Joab saying, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent Uriah to David. Uriah came to him. David asked concerning the welfare of Joab and the people and the state of war. And David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house, wash your feet." And Uriah went out of the king's house, and a present from the king was sent out after him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. And when they told David, saying, "Uriah did not go down to his house," David said to Uriah, "Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" And Uriah said to David, here's Uriah's answer, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing." Take what Uriah just said, and if you put those words in David's mouth at the beginning of the chapter, how different is this story? If David said, "Joab's in the open field, and my men are in the open field, and the ark's in the open field, how dare I stay at home and lie with my wife? I'll be out there." It's a totally different story. So Uriah gives the answer that David should have really in the first place. Uriah abstains, and David doesn't. Verse 12, David said to Uriah, stay here today also, and tomorrow we'll let you go. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next, and David called him, and he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his bed with his Lord's servants, but he did not go down to his house. And so he adds this in, and this is one we don't even think about, but what did he do to Uriah there? He got him drunk. Is that a sin or not? To purposely get a man drunk. I mean, so we don't even talk about that one because it's kind of low on the totem pole compared to murder. But that's not good either. In the morning, David will send a letter by the hand of Uriah. And to summarize here, he's going to tell Joab, have Uriah put to death. Set him in a spot in the battle where he's going to die. Now imagine how far down that hole David's gone. And this is the scary thing to me about sin, just so terrifying, is that David is a really good guy. Can we agree that we like David as a general rule? And yet, how quickly has this spiraled out of control? He writes a letter saying, have Uriah left out where he's going to die in battle. He seals it with the king's seal and hands it to Uriah. Uriah literally will hand his own death note to Joab. Now, this is bad on several different levels. One, we're doing some searing of our conscience here. And now, we are now adding to the one sin another. We've laid with another man's wife, and now we have gotten him drunk, and now we're going to enlist the help of Joab to murder a man. Does anybody remember how David felt when Joab murdered Abner? Remember that? We went through that whole thing, and how mad David was that he would kill a man in cold blood. If you're Joab, and you get this letter, what does that do to David's reputation? Just flushed it all down the toilet, haven't you? Any sort of chance of being the man with higher integrity, the reputation of truth and honesty and dignity, all went away because he's going to have to enlist Joab to fulfill his goal of having Uriah put to death. Joab will do that, and then Joab will send message back. And by the way, it will mention in Joab will know that in the letter he'll mention that several other people died too. And it says in verse 25, the messenger said to David, the men prevailed against us and came out against us in the field, but we pressed them as far as the entrance of the gate. Moreover, the archer shot at your servants from the wall, so some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead. And then David said to the messenger, thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Make your battle against the city stronger and overthrow it, and so encourage him. So in order to kill Uriah and make it look like a battle thing, they have to get so close into the walls that the archers begin to shoot, and Uriah is not the only one who's killed. There's other people killed in this. And so David, when he hears about it, he says, basically tell Joab, that's fine. These things, they happen. It's part of battle. But they don't just happen. Joab would have never made that sort of tactical decision if it wasn't for David's goals there. And so we have this thing that spirals entirely out of control. And verse 26 says, now when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. And when the time of mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife, and then she bore him a son. But the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. And so here, David at this point has essentially thought, I've gotten away with it, but it's evil in the sight of the Lord. Which means if it's evil in the sight of the Lord, what did the Lord do? He saw it. So even if everybody else was hidden from, who saw it? God does. And so this lays out all that we've seen at this point. Does anybody have any comments or questions or anything like that there on chapter 11? Okay, so then There we go. Okay, so Nathan will come and present him with a message from God. And he'll do it in the form of a parable. He'll talk about two men, one being rich and the other being poor, and the rich man having a lot of sheep and the poor man having only one, and how the rich man, when he had visitors, took the poor man's one lamb and took it and slew it and presented it for the feast. And David gets furious about the whole thing. And he says, as the Lord lives, surely a man who has done this deserves to die. He must make restitution for the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and had no compassion. So David's answer to the guy who took another man's lamb is he should have to pay back fourfold for the lamb. Now I mention this because in the end, this is really what's going to happen. David has taken Bathsheba, another man's wife, and in the end, what's going to happen is David's going to lose four sons over it. He's going to lose Amnon, who will not be a good guy. He's going to rape his sister, and then his brother Absalom will kill him. He's going to lose Absalom, who will try and revolt against David, destroy him, and then is going to be killed in battle by Joab. He's going to lose Adonijah, who tries to make himself king instead of Solomon, and Solomon's going to end up having to kill him. And he's going to lose one other son. Who is it? It's the baby. He's going to lose the baby. And I don't know. You know, there's some things that are in Scripture, and you just go, huh, that's a funny connection. I don't know whether that's just turned out that way or whether that's something there. But in the case of David, where he says he should make restitution for the lamb fourfold, those are David's words because he did this thing and he had no compassion. It turns out David's going to lose four kids over this. I don't know whether that is this being fulfilled specifically or that is just a coincidence, but I found it to be interesting. Either way, we can certainly say that David's going to face a lot of natural consequences for this particular sin. And so David's going to be confronted with it, be told that he is the man, and since we're at time, we'll stop there and pick up at God's conversation with David after he accepts the sin next week.